Hi there and good evening. Welcome to the Jim Bohannon Show, as we're going to be talking about something tonight which has probably accounted for more shows than any other subject that we've had over the years. And I've been at this network talking now for the last 36 years. Healthcare is high up there, but nothing can top the topic that we have this evening. We're talking with Gene Dattle. He has written the book Reckoning with Race, published by Encounter Books, and subtitled America's Failure. Gene, good to have you with us.
Good evening, Jim. Thanks.
You bet. I look at just as an overview to get things started here. Goodness knows we started out on a terrible, terrible wrong foot and the centuries of outright slavery that existed. Then, of course, we had that final coming to a head that I think everybody, even the founding fathers who kicked the slavery can down the road, knew was coming. And indeed, 47 years later, there they were. And at the cost of a lot of lives, we finally got rid of slavery and then brought about could be called, I suppose, a century of slavery light, in which you couldn't really buy and sell people, but the rights of those who had been emancipated were certainly less than those of the rest of the country. Then, around 1965, there came the massive revolution, which brought the law onto the right side of things. Now, certainly I wish that we had a time machine to go back and eliminate slavery. I wish we had a magic wand that could get rid of individual acts of bigotry in a nation of 325 million people. There are going to be some people like that. But other than magic wands and time machines, I am not sure just exactly what more we could have do. We were terribly, terribly late. I'll grant that. But again, you can't fix what has been. You can only fix what is now. And so I wonder about your subtitle, Reckoning with Race, certainly a major subject. America's Failure? I'm just not so sure that for the past half century I would call it that.
In general, I think there's been progress since the 1960s, but we're a long way from where we should be. I mean, your audience needs to ask several questions in terms of the status of African-American progress today, and are we progressing towards economic equality, and were we moving towards racial unity before Donald Trump? I mean, if you want to look at some numbers in terms of both economics and education, we're not there yet. And I'm not sure that without a lot of structural changes, we can get to where we want to be. And in terms of the economic equality that I speak about, and in terms of an assimilated nation, we are the only grand experiment in a multi-ethnic society.
All right. Looking at that, just talking about the economic equality issue, goodness knows the doors have been opened. It took a long time. But if you practice discrimination in this day and age against somebody on economic opportunity or equality, you're in a world of hurt. And while I grant you that we have a K through 12 educational system primarily financed by the property tax, and I don't think that's a very good way to pay for that. And while, yes, the super-rich palace schools with the platinum-lined laboratories tend to be very white school districts, that's true. That does not alter the fact that there is not a person in this country, even in the worst schools, who cannot get the high school diploma, who cannot get to a community college, cannot get to a state university, and go on to earn doctorates, medical doctors, lawyers, degrees, what have you. That is certainly not what I would call ideal, but it's not as though the door has been slammed in the faces of these people institutionally, as was once the case. Today, in far too many cases, you're talking about people who have simply ignored the opportunities that have been given to them and ignored the dozens of times that even high school dropouts have heard dozens of times. Study, learn skills, become employable. They've all heard that, and far too many people have ignored the opportunities that are there. So from society's point of view, Gene, I'm not sure what more we could do except maybe yell another dozen times, please use the opportunities that are there for you.
Yes, I think that it seems obvious what needs to be done. But in terms of, then we look at the black family structure, and then you see some of the issues that you have to deal with that are virtually insurmountable at this point in time. For example, in a society that has 70% of its children under 18 in single-parent homes is a very difficult obstacle to overcome. And so once we all agree on things like colorblind middle-class norms, education, two-parent family, discipline, hard work, efficiency, self-control and responsibility, then we'll get there. Let me give you an example. Cory Booker, which most of the audience knows as the senator from New Jersey, wrote a memoir last year in which he said his mother and father were his constant mentors and greatest teachers. They taught him the connection between hard work, discipline, and reward. Unfortunately, he didn't talk a lot more about that in the book. So I think we're going to have to look for leadership within the black community. I don't think it can be superimposed by the white community. And there have been enormous number of programs, as you know, since the 1960s. And most of the big programs have failed in terms of getting a mass of black people into the economic mainstream. There's several programs, smaller ones that I found that have been successful. But, I mean, when you look at the status of education today, what you're seeing is, in terms of the path that you've outlined, only 6% in terms of several testing arrangements, 6% of all black high school graduates are deemed ready for college at this point. You have in New York City, which has not skimped in terms of finance. I'll go through the budget if you want me to, but since 1959, it has kept up and is more than inflation. You've got 20% of black children, grade 3 through 8, who are not doing math, who are only doing math at grade level. 80% are not. 27 are reading at grade level. And this goes, then you immediately see, and New York is a highly segregated school system and residential area, as you know. So so you've got a school system that's been funded very well that's not working. The other aspects of this in terms of the segregated environment are really penalized. For example, historically, black colleges and universities have only a 34% graduation rate at this point in time. So you've got enormous problems in that community, which has been segregated, not only in terms of overt legal segregation or slavery, but in terms of a containment policy. And we really have to look back at history to understand this, because the place to start, we know what the South was like. We know what slavery was like. But what we really need to understand is what the antebellum North was like. That seems like a long way away, but it's not. Because there, you could be an abolitionist, and yet you could be anti-black. The main attitude of the antebellum North was to prevent a pervasive migration of blacks north. And you can see this in the Oregon State Constitution, as you probably know, 1857, Oregon, with 52,000 people and 100 blacks, had a black exclusion law. So when we think about the way we're taught history today, which is that there was a prohibition on slavery in the West, what we have to understand, it was not only a prohibition against slavery, it was a prohibition against free blacks moving there. So what happened during Reconstruction? During Reconstruction, it was dead on arrival, and this is basically not the conventional view. And it's because white Northerners were not going to shed white Southern blood for black rights. You, in effect, created a containment policy of keeping blacks in the South. And between 1865 and 1914, the black population of the North stayed under 2% when almost 20 million white immigrants came into this country. In 1900, 90% of all black people lived in the South. So in order to understand this, what would have happened if the white North had been remotely racially tolerant? You would have had a migration of blacks north before 1914, before the Great Migration.
Did. And this is a lot, of course, to digest, and we're going to come back and cover a lot of that and also take some of your calls for our guest, Gene Dattle, D-A-T-T-E-L, the book Reckoning with Race. Just to note some of the things that Gene brought up just now in terms of whose fault are some of these problems. 70% of African-American kids grow up in single-parent households. To a certain extent, I believe you could say that that is society's fault by the programs of dependency that have been fostered and pushed. It would be helpful if the black community, quite frankly, put more, I think the term is shame on people. That used to be the case in this country. Oh, she's not married and pregnant, and it applied to whites as well as black. And these days, of course, well, whatever. We got a little baby factory over here, and that is not good for anybody involved. In terms of the 6% of black high school graduates who are ready for college, there are pass-through policies out there that will just pass them through. I don't care if they can read the diploma. Here's your diploma. If we have them in a building with books in the same building, maybe by osmosis, you will get the knowledge into their heads. And that's, I think, a part of the problem as well. And these are just a few of the things. In terms of historic black colleges having a 34% graduation rate, I would add one comment, and that would be this. That may be somewhat symptomatic of progress. And that is to say that once you had integration of colleges beyond the historic black colleges, then the state schools and in some cases the Ivy League schools siphoned off the best and the brightest students, and often left the more marginal cases for these historic black colleges. So my thought there would be that that might be, in a backhanded kind of way, a sign of progress. Briefly, your comments, and we'll take a break.
Yes, actually, what is going to happen to the historical black colleges is what happened to the football powerhouses, Grambling. They all went to integrated colleges. But even the best ones like Spelman or Morehouse or Howard are having financial difficulty. One of the things that's very interesting in terms of black loyalty and black pride is the lack of alumni giving to historically black colleges and universities. It's at 11%. Some colleges have only 2%. Even a place like Morehouse, only 8% of the alumni donate to the school. At Howard, it's only 12%. So you've got this interesting paradox where there's an alleged black loyalty, but they're not giving money to their own schools.
Stay with us. More to come, including your calls. 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. As you can see from our discussion thus far, Gene Dattle has written a very important book, Reckoning with Race, America's Failure, published by Encounter Books. And our guest, by the way, has seen it and lived it. Mississippi Delta born, third generation, lived in a majority black, ethnically diverse local community, and went on to such places as Yale. He has been there, and he has done that. 1-866-50-JIMBO, back in a moment. A beautiful sight. Are we ever going to fix this? 1-866-50-JIMBO. There are those who are certainly offering reasoning and evidence to try and help us do so, and one of them is Gene Dattle, our guest in this portion of the program, his new book, Reckoning with Race. Here's David in Creston, Iowa. Hello, David.
Hi, thanks for taking my call, Jim. Mm-hmm. I like to try to look at this in kind of a simple way, but with a lot of people probably don't look at it. You know, there's just as many whites in this country as there are blacks that dislike each other. And there are just as much whites that accept the blacks, and the blacks accept the whites. Now, it's such that the division of this thing. And I think on both sides, white or black, if they could understand why they're prejudiced, you know, they need an education. You know, they need to have some mental adjustments here to find out why I don't like them and each other, you know. And if they would try to reach some of these people, usually it's an IQ, I would imagine. I know there's a lot of blacks out there and a lot of whites that are hating me to say this. But, it's too bad it's the truth and the fact that they need to take a deep look into themselves their attitude, why they're prejudiced.
All right. And, we get the thrust of what you're saying, David, and let's let our guest respond to that. There are people out there who do not care for circumstances that place them in the company of other people. That's one reason, I guess, why we self-segregate. So how about that?
Both sides self-segregate. And one of the problems is there's very little contact between the races, and I think that would open up a whole new world. Let me give you an example. At one of my reunions a year ago, I went to at Yale a lecture on implicit bias, and the psychologist from Yale was talking about this, and he had lots of graphs on the board with these minuscule differences in terms of implicit bias, and he got to one example, and I stopped him. It was a black patient going to a white doctor, and he said there was implicit bias, lack of trust, and he showed this graph, and he was moving along, and I said, wait a second, was that the first visit? And he said, yes. Then he tried to move along again, and I raised my hand again, and I said, what happened after subsequent visits? And he said, the lack of trust dissipated. And I think that's one of the things that in this highly polarized world, which has generally always been, this is nothing new that Trump brought in. We have had a polarized world forever. For example, by 1966, New York City knew that it couldn't integrate its school system. By 1970, the litigators for the NAACP and then Brown had decided that model schools for blacks was the answer, not an integrated school system. So, you know, you've got a situation where you have two societies. That was brought out in the Kerner Commission report, which says we have two societies, one black, one white.
Well, you know, as long as our schools are residential schools, and goodness knows busing kids 30 miles and they spend half their day traveling has some serious problems. As long as our schools are residential and we have residential segregation, you're going to have school segregation.
Exactly, except in New York, where it's not where you could actually move zones very easily, and even in New York on the liberal Upper West Side, they're having difficulty merging two schools, PS 199 and PS 191. So it's
what, liberal
more than
hypocrisy?
The residents at
I'm
this
shocked.
Point.
Go ahead. I'm sorry.
No, I think there has to be some sort of artificial way of dealing with this, and I think this the school system, as we know in terms of secondary school, is very much segregated. And even when blacks go to white schools, one of the things that bothers me now is, again, a self-segregation in terms
of
the University of Oregon.
We're coming up on a break here that doesn't move, and the computer will cut us off if I don't. So I will, by simply noting that I know exactly where Gene is going, and I agree with him completely. We'll talk about that and take more calls in just a moment. Welcome back to the Jim Bohannon Show at 1-866-50-JIMBO, 1-866-505-4626. Gene Dattle is our guest in this portion of the program. He is a cultural and economic historian, and he offers some considerable food for thought, a banquet for thought, in the book Reckoning with Race, America's Failure, published by Encounter Books. Lots of calls out there, but before we get to those, Gene was bringing up something that has long bothered me, and that is what I call, I think is what you're talking about, a voluntary resegregation of America. And I remember, and again, I was in school in the Jurassic era, but I can remember this was long after the Civil Rights Acts were passed, and there would be the black table in the cafeteria, there'd be the Hispanic table, and this sort of thing. There'd be some other tables as well. There'd be a jock table if they were indeed eating with us peons. But there was a voluntary resegregation that always bothered me. Is that what you were talking about, Gene?
Yes, in terms of now we're getting to the point where we're discussing separate dorms, which you have at the University of Oregon and at the University of Connecticut as well, or the overemphasis on cultural centers at the expense of the overall university. And now in some of the schools, you're having symbolic separate graduations, which I think detracts from the unity of an institution.
This is enough to make a Klansman blush. I have heard of this, and I absolutely, my jaw rarely drops anymore, but it dropped for that. Then why don't we just bring back Jim Crow? I mean, I think that is the most ridiculous thing I've ever heard.
Yeah, it's a move backward. And also, just in terms of the classroom itself, I mean, America has warts, as every civilization does, but you can't look at this whole series of grievances and call it a general American history. I mean, we have to understand what the Founding Fathers were all about. We need to understand what the Federalist Papers are and the enormous adaptive capacity of this society. I've lived in Japan, as you probably know, for 9 years, and I saw what it was like to live in a homogeneous society that's hierarchical, that admits of nobody from the outside. Very difficult adjustment issues. The same with Europe. Europe is a homogeneous society. We have set us a,
well, less so of late, but yes.
But even of the. Even with the immigrant migration to Europe, there are serious problems. Germany, 82 million people, 3 million Turkish immigrants and settlers there. Huge problems in terms of immigration assimilation issues there. It's not working that
yeah.
well.
All right, now let's take some calls for our guest.
One of the things that I wanted to mention, and you
yeah.
brought, there has been enormous progress, but I looked in the book. And tried to determine what the difference in terms of the black leadership was in the 1960s and today. And if you go back to Martin Luther King mm-hmm. or Whitney Young of the National Urban League or Roy Wilkins, they all talked about preparation for a competitive society, and they all used the word preparation, and they all used the phrase stand up honestly to our own shortcomings. So that's something you're not going to hear today.
Yeah, and that's part of the problem, I think. Scott in Worcester, Massachusetts, calls in to talk with Gene Dattle, the author of Reckoning with Race. Good evening, Scott.
Good evening, Mr. Bohan and Mr. Dattle. You know, integration and busing, let's be honest, have been a failure in America.
Well, I wouldn't say that. I think it has had its problems. I wouldn't call the concept of integration a failure.
You can have all the laws on the books, but you can't regulate the human heart. A lot of the problems lie with blacks, and I'm talking about they've been given special rights. They have a ghetto mentality through affirmative action.
Some may have. Let's not try to generalize too much here, Scott.
Reverse discrimination, social promotions. A lot of houses have no father figure in the home.
All right. Well, we have covered much of this, and we get where you're coming from. All right, Gene, what about attitudes such as Scott outlined, which are not maybe as pervasive as all blacks are, et cetera, et cetera. But there are certainly elements of truth there. So, Gene?
Yes, and I think in terms of the extreme part of the black community, for example, the Black Lives Matter and the militant blacks, what you've seen is an attitude that says there can be no reverse racial discrimination. And that means that the oppressed can never be discriminated against. And even the Southern Poverty Law Center founder, Morris Dees, has sued two black entities, Alabama State College and actually Macon County. It's not a black entity, but for reverse race discrimination and has won. And he said he wasn't going to tolerate whites discriminating blacks, and he wasn't going to tolerate blacks discriminating against whites. And in Worcester, Massachusetts, Clark University, the diversity person there in the New York Times has actually said there's no such thing as reverse race discrimination. So on these extreme levels, you've got a very much a separatist attitude at this point in time. It's almost hate.
Well, let me offer a thought here as we go to another call, and that would be this. First of all, affirmative action, by its very definition, does in fact apply preferences based on race, and I would call that discrimination in the beginning, and I did, and I still do say it was necessary. However much there was a negative factor to that, it was absolutely essential to knocking down barriers that were not going to go away any other way. I have always said that I found affirmative action to be a necessary evil. That is how I termed it in the beginning, and it's how I still term it, except that sooner or later, Gene, in my opinion, I'd like to hear yours, sooner or later, it has got to be phased out. We cannot go in perpetuity setting aside things for one race over another. Once you have knocked down the barriers and once you have opened doors, which I think largely we have done, at some point it needs to be phased out, in my view. What's yours?
Well, that was the original thought in terms of the Supreme Court. Senator Day O'Connor said this would not last more than 25 years.
Yeah, right.
And so, again, that's another example that there has – the key word here is mass. And what I want to get is a mass movement of black Americans into the economic mainstream. And you can't do it with affirmative action. Affirmative action perhaps has helped some people, but it's not going to help the mass of black people.
All right. Now, there's a call from John in Mitchell, South Dakota. Hello, John.
Yes. Hello, Jimbo. I've got a question that goes back to the Civil War, and that is I'm looking at a picture of the Confederate monument at Arlington National Cemetery, which has carved into it Confederate soldiers that are black.
Now, wait a minute. Hold on. Confederate soldiers, which are black?
Yeah, these are black people that are dressed in the Confederate uniform.
I was not aware of such a statue, and I certainly wasn't aware of the presence of anybody in the Confederate forces who was black and wearing such a uniform. But okay, go ahead.
Well, this is a monument at Arlington National Cemetery.
Okay.
But anyway, I'm just asking the question, if this was a racial or if this is a slave issue back there, why would these people, these black people, put on the Confederate uniform with something that they detested?
Well, I'm not aware of that ever occurring, although there were discussions of that. And at one point, I believe, Gene Dattle, that Robert E. Lee even suggested that toward the closing moments of the Civil War as the South was desperately short for manpower. But other than using blacks as workers, that is, carrying supplies for the troops and things of that nature, I'm not aware of any black that ever wore the uniform. And I can guarantee you there were no armed black Confederate troops.
There were a handful that really did join the Confederacy. And if you will Google in Waco, Texas, a statue of Holt Collier, you will see a black Confederate soldier. So there is one in Waco, Texas.
That was specifically not – that was in violation of what was coming out of Richmond.
Both sides, the Union and the Confederacy, had a lot of difficulties in terms of drafting people. So at a certain point, the Confederacy would have done that.
They might well have, but I know that that was never okayed by Jefferson Davis and the Confederate War Department. If that happened in Texas, maybe it happened, but the point at which the South didn't have much hope anyway. But I don't believe there was ever an official.
No, that actually happened fairly early on. But what I was saying is there were huge draft problems on both sides, and this gets racial because in 1862 there were these black refugees behind Union lines. The question was what to do with them. They were a real nuisance in terms of the fighting power of the Union soldiers. In 1862, General John Dix tried to send them to Massachusetts, abolitionist Massachusetts. Mm-hmm. John Andrew, one of the governor of Massachusetts and a hero of the movie Glory, said, "No, we don't want them. They'll end up as paupers." 2 years later, Governor Andrew, mm-hmm. wrote to Lincoln and asked for black refugees to come there. What he was looking for were recruits for his draft quotas in the Union Army.
Right.
So, again, that has a racial connotation. Is we want black, but what we want to have from the four is to be drafted.
Exactly. We'll take a quick break and back with more calls in a moment. Nice sentiments, Steve and Paul, and we're working on it. 1-866-50-JIMBO. Gene Dattle has written Reckoning with Race. This is Charlie in Sheridan, Wyoming. Hello, Charlie.
Well, you got a lot of callers, so I'll make this real quick. 2 points. The first one on, he mentioned economic equality. I would encourage people on that score to read the works of Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell. And also consider that we have now in the war in poverty since 65. Latest figures show that we've spent $22 trillion on that. As to education in the black community, there was a wonderful book written about 14, 15 years ago entitled Black American Students in an Affluent Suburb. It was written by, based on a study by a University of California, Berkeley professor, and it found very quickly that academic performance of black students, not only did they perform less well than white students at every social class level in this suburb, but also less well than immigrant minority students. So I think Walter Williams and Thomas Sowell have a wealth of personal knowledge about this.
All right. Well, certainly Walter Williams. I'm not sure we've had Walter Williams on this show or not, but we have definitely had Thomas Sowell on many an occasion. Gene Daddle, your thoughts about what Charlie has offered.
Yeah, the study that he's referring to, which I discuss in my book, you know, is by an ethnic Nigerian who was teaching at Berkeley. His name is Ogbu. And what he found was that the attitudes towards education were there was an anti-education bias within the black community. And I think we express that now as acting white. And that's one of the things that Ogbu mentioned that was really a problem within the black community that had nothing to do with past injustices.
Why are people who say things like that, you're acting like Whitey, why do people who say that, why are they not condemned as the lowest form of Uncle Tom? That's what they are. The notion that to be intellectual is to be white, as I say, that would make a Klansman blush. Are you kidding me? How could that possibly permeate modern African-American society?
Well, one of the problems would be peer pressure in the black society, and there, one of my major points is within the society there is an immunity from any form of self-examination or self-criticism, so that it's really something that holds that society back. The peer pressure that's exerted on the individual within society. So you can have a private conversation with a black person in which he will say things that he will not say publicly.
Okay. 1-866-50-JIMBO, and more calls to come. We will get to your calls, by the way, if not this hour, next hour, so just stay on the line. Back in a moment. Welcome back to the Jimbo Hannon Show. Gene Daddle, our guest, his book, Reckoning with Race, and we talked to Robert in Suffield, Ohio. Hello, Robert.
Good evening. I'd like to start off with, I have a question. When you're married, and I would like to ask you, when you decided to have a family or have children, didn't you kind of make sure you could afford it before you had a
This child? Is certainly an issue, and let's bring it up with our guest. That is something that and thank you for your call. This is certainly something that has long bothered me, Gene. If you can't afford a family or a family of a certain size, then it's the responsible thing to do is not to have the child until such time as you can afford to pay for the child.
Yes, I mean there's no arguing with that. This is even conservatives say that a lot of the problems in terms of the black family started with the welfare system in the war on poverty. It began a lot earlier than that. I mean, Du Bois was talking about it as the single biggest problem in 1908.
Yeah, but it was exacerbated by the welfare, however well-meaning it was.
Yeah, and E. Franklin Frazier was writing in the 1930s. The chapter titles of his book were Illegitimacy, Desertion, and Juvenile Delinquency. And by the 1950s, he was talking about the lack of eligible black men. That's even before the Moynihan Report. And even Malcolm X was talking about it. So, I mean, this is something that's been endemic in that society for a long time. I mean, clearly there has been a solid middle class. We have three classes of blacks now, an underclass, which is quite large, mm-hmm. a middle class, which has a fragile asset base, and an elite that's excelled in every aspect of American life.
Mm-hmm.
So the question we're dealing with is this: is this income gap? Back to your the questioner before, and a lot of it is structural in terms of even majors in college. Georgetown does a study, and their blacks are highly representative in majors that are associated with community work and very low earning. So you're not going to see that gap close until there is a more of an appreciation in the private sector in the black community.
All right. To Jackie in Watertown, Wisconsin. Hello, Jackie.
Hello, Mr. Bowen, and hello to your guest. This is going to make a lot of people angry, and I'm sorry. But that elite that you were talking about, I know that there are a lot of them that try and get back to their community. But there is also an attitude, if I got mine, and I'm not going to help you get yours.
We've got a minute left for our guest to respond, and that's a very great point. To what extent have we seen people express that attitude among the black elite? I got mine, and the hell with the rest of you, as opposed to those who go back into the ghetto and talk to school students, et cetera.
There could be a lot more improvement in terms of the black elite dealing with the problems as role models, et cetera, within the black community.
Mm-hmm. Suffice it to say that we will continue this discussion in the next hour. Our guest, Gene Dattle, I'll be happy to talk with everyone myself about these issues because goodness knows I've had practice over the years, and it's worth discussing. It's worth considering, and this is a good starting point right here. The book, Reckoning with Race, America's Failure, Gene Dattle, our guest, and he is the author of this Encounter Books publication, which offers a lot of historic perspective on things that you probably haven't thought about, such as the northern migration of blacks. It didn't happen overnight, and why it didn't. Just to name one of many subjects that are not ordinarily covered in our history. I'm Jim.